Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. I am your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group. And for this episode, VFE, I got one of my close brothers on the episode. Really quick, just to say, hey, you know, Luvel, I want you to be on my episode. They need to hear, my audience need to hear your strategies, your thinking, your methodologies with regards to culture in education, as well as innovation in education. So to have my close brother, Dr. Luvel Brown on VFB is an extreme honor. Just to give you a background of Dr. Brown, Dr. Brown is one of the most recognized superintendents across the country. Numerous awards that he have won nationally, too many to announce on VFE. And he is the proud superintendent of Ithaca Public Schools in Ithaca, New York. You know, we live roughly about 2.5 hours away from each other, so we've got to connect much more frequently. So I want to bring to you on today's episode, Dr. Luvel Brown. Dr. Brown, big brother, how are you today?
I am outstanding. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for including me, Dr. Connor. This is an honor. And whenever you and I are in the room together, it's fun. So I'm looking forward to this conversation as well.
Man, I need some more Dr. Luvel Brown in my life, man. I tell you, you know, when we get together, you know, whether it be just connecting with education, just hanging out, I'll tell you this, man. If you have not been to Dr. Luvel Brown's residence, you have to. The bourbon collection is for real.
we work hard, but we also play hard, if you know what I mean. So we have a good time around here.
Oh, man, Luvel, it's so good to have you on here. So, you know, to start, you know, the podcast, this kind of segues perfectly into your first question. And I ask everybody this first question, and specifically pertaining to you, I cannot wait to hear your response, my brother. Now, when stakeholders engage with you, man, nationally, you go around the country speaking, you know, about culture and education, your stakeholders, your leaders in Ithaca, when they engage or listen to Dr. Luvel Brown as a superintendent or a national speaker, Dr. Brown, what equity song comes to mind when they first meet you or hear you speak?
All right, got you. Thanks for that wonderful question. I'm thinking about my walk-up music. What would it be? And yes, I've had a chance to be, what a privilege and honor to be in every state, probably 17 different countries now over the last few years. And I would say that that song would be a smooth operator. You know, I call it Sadie, and those people call it Sade, but it's Sadie for me. And I say that because being in so many different spaces and being an educator, my role and my job is to differentiate based on where people are on their journeys. And when able to use language in ways to engage everyone, when able to make all folks feel comfortable, when able to do things people can choose not to, it takes a level of confidence, expertise, and talent, but also a level of smoothness, as I call it. I'm a smooth operator. Having folks feel comfortable with these oftentimes uncomfortable conversations is a superpower of mine. And I'm just honored to have an opportunity to engage with so many different people.
Yeah. And, you know, I've heard you speak nationally, right? And even within your district, talking about your superpower. We're going to elaborate on that as we further get into the podcast. But, you know, I got, and I'm going to tell my audience this, I got a nickname for Dr. Luvel Brown. Dr. Luvel Brown is the Tyson Beckford of education. So when he said, you know, his song is smooth operator, absolutely smooth with it. But here's the thing, the vitality with the content, which makes it so smooth. You know, when you hear about differentiation, when you hear about engagement, when you hear about using your superpower to be able to positively change and also curtail culture, as I said, we're going to get into that. The way Dr. Brown does it is just very, very, very smooth. So that is an appropriate song for you, my brother. I saw when you sing that, I just started saying, smooth operator. But Dr. Brown, getting into the next question, right? You are the proud superintendent of Ithaca Public Schools in Ithaca, New York, right? And New York has always been perceived as the innovation hub in the United States. But you're considered a czar. specifically in the area of organizational culture. And the way you unwrap culture makes it simple, right? It looks like it's simplified, but at the same time, it is very arduous to change. You have implemented these progressive policies with regards to culture change and how to lament equity through your work of love, right? Creating that culture of love. Now, from a systems and classroom perspective, right? How do you democratize that change over time in a teaching and learning organization that is underpinned by a culture of love using your theory and research?
I know I'm in the presence of brilliance and excellence when I'm asked a question that deep. So thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to reflect and to learn and use the word. I love that word, democratize. And, you know, the best democracies are those that are stable and those that have stability and leadership and those that are committed. And I would say it starts there. You know, I'm coming up on finishing my 13th year as a superintendent in this amazing, beautiful town, Ithaca, New York. And we've been on a beautiful journey together. So just that alone, 13 years, close to 13 years, through all of the struggle, through all of the resistance, through all of the successes, that's a long time. And what I and my governance team and my community have committed to was to partner on this work and this journey together. We've grown up together. And when you grow up together, that requires a significant amount, as I mentioned, love. And that love involves forgiveness, that love involves trust, that love involves a deep level of caring, empathy. And what you don't hear is ego. Yeah, you know, you and I both, but because of the gifts and talents we have, we've had opportunities to be anywhere. And, you know, I have chosen to stay in this community and make it my own. I have a 50-year vision for this community and the school district, and to get there, it's gonna require me to stay for a long time. So this democracy is strong because it's stable and it's committed to the work. Now, we've also, throughout my time, we've had to develop some common understandings and mental models for language. And language is important. We've used language throughout the history of our species to dehumanize. We've used it to exclude. We've used it to divide. We've used the language to build, to construct, to collaborate. Now, you got to have a lot of common mental models around what language is and what words are. Words like equity and inclusion and diversity means something to us. Now, we spend a lot of time defining those terms and coming up with what those terms mean for us. And what we've landed on is that it's good for, what I'm talking about here is good for everybody. It's not polarizing. It does not create us versus them. It's not a zero-sum game. This work that we are about here is for everybody. And we had to come, we had to get real tight about the words we would use to describe it. Because, you know, when you truly reflect in real ways about language and come up with common understandings, nobody can tell you what you're saying. You know what it is. So I talk about the language first and then the process. We've been very clear about a process, and we'll get into that later, I'm sure. But we've defined the process we would go through together. And it's an iterative and ongoing process. And we're very clear, again, with language, about where we are in that process. We'll come back to it a little bit, I'm sure, but we talk about where we are when we're reflecting. We talk about where we are when we're building and in engaging in the friction and the conflict. We talk about where we are when it's time to sit down and write a new policy. So we got to be clear about where we are in the process, how long said processes will take, and, you know, we celebrate when we navigate through those stages of the process. So I hope I'm giving you a sense of that democracy. We're very clear.
I'll tell you this, Dr. Brown, I'm just capturing all of your sentiments that you're highlighting, and you perfectly contextualized how to be able to change culture at its root, right? When you talk about this, this mental model alignment, that is the biggest shift in culture, right? Mm-hmm. And I want to reference, because you highlighted, I mean, perfectly contextualized what, you know, a lot of executive leaders do is focus on the structural aspects of culture. You are going into the content aspects of the culture, where now, you know, you're looking at these latent and manifested, I like to say, notions in a culture where you're aligning mental model with the two most critical elements, language, shared language, common language, as you talked about, brother, and delineating and defining processes around culture. I mean, that right there, see, I explained it. I will explain it like that, Dr. Brown, but people will come to you and be like, how do you do this? Like, oh, okay. It's like that because you simplified it, right? You simplified culture where now it's addressing very big theoretical frames. Now, I appreciate that, brother, because, you know, it could be easily deteriorated. What we see in education around equity, inclusion, and justice work, but the intentionality around the language development and the processes that is focused on this mental model, it underscores what you're stating, democratizing culture. But again, you talk about this high level of commitment. Commitment needs to be embedded within any organization around this. And 13 years, man, I tell you, everybody should look up to you, brother. I mean, if you make it past two these days, you're considered a vet. 13 and one. If you want to find out what the strategy is of how to align governance to a mental model around some of the most contentious work, equity, inclusion, and justice, go to Ithaca, New York, and reach out to Dr. Brown. But, you know, Dr. Brown, I want to now talk about your national work, right? And congratulations, because right now you're currently campaigning for the National Association for Black School Educators, NAPSE, National President. Okay, making big moves, right? Now, we know, you know, that our NAPSE, you know, Dr. Tebow, who's the executive director, a lot of the state affiliates, I'm a part of GNAPSE, the Greater New England chapter of NAPSE. So, but this organization has a rich history supporting Black superintendents, leaders, teachers, and educators across the country. Now, to my audience, right, I have a big audience that, you know, as a part of NAPSE, I have a big audience that, you know, have votes for NAPSE. Yeah. So if you were elected president of NAPSE, and this is going back to now, you got to go back 13 years ago with this entry plan.
Yeah.
What would your first days look like as president-elect and president of NAPSE? And also, how would you achieve a vision that would impact all NAPSE affiliates across this country?
Thank you for that question. And it has truly been an honor to be a member of NAPSE. And it would be a privilege and an honor for sure to be elected into this very important role at this very important time. I think through my leadership, what I have done as a superintendent, what I've done as an educator is most importantly, honor the past. I know that we stand on the shoulders of giants. We are here because of the work that our elders have done to put us in this position to have this voice and these opportunities. So I will honor the past and, you know, lead us to the new future. To, you know, see, NAPSE has a bright future ahead, and it's going to require someone, myself, frankly, with my talents as a leader that's able to assess very quickly current state, very quickly establish some relationships, particularly the relationships that are needed for very strategic partnerships and work. Mm-hmm. And then, hey, implement. Us superintendents, we know you survive the superintendency 1 year and then 13 years by assessing the current state, providing a vision for the future, building relationships, and then implementing very effectively and efficiently. And we have some work to do with NAPSE. There's financial stability that needs to be achieved. Most national organizations have had struggles, particularly most recently with the pandemic. What we do now and what we do next will allow for us to survive and create a sustainable future, irrespective of future pandemics and other issues, other crises. So financial stability is important. And as a leader, as a superintendent, I've been fortunate to be a part of some redesign and overhaul and saving of institutions in need of financial support. Mm-hmm. And then I would also say, you know, I'm also, because of my work nationally and my connections to corporate partners and strategic partners, I think NAPSE needs to think more, do more to partner with some of the biggest and best organizations in the country, corporate partners, but specifically as we look to be sustainable, do more and more bigger events, a more sustainable conference approach, and professional development. I've seen other organizations that have done much to spearhead and provide professional development and additional support for leaders. NAPSE should be the leader of that work. And so I see us at NAPSE doing some work, particularly with my professional development background and connecting with folks like yourself. We should be the primary source for the best professional development, particularly when it comes to engaging and teaching our young people, our Black and Brown students all over the country. So financial stability, corporate partnerships, and professional development would be the would be a big part of my entry plan if given this wonderful opportunity.
Yeah, no, that is compelling, right? Because, NAPSE is near and dear to my heart, right? And obviously, you know, honoring the past is essential, is critical with anything that you do. But also, I love how you said to propel to the vision, right? And corporate partnerships, that's strategic intent behind it, implementation, financial stability, absolutely. Professional development and support to leaders. And Dr. Brown, you know, more than ever, we're seeing this rapid change of leadership, right? Especially with Black leaders across the country at the executive level, even at the site level. I heard a statistic, I believe it was roughly a year ago, which caught my attention that the Black male superintendent is at a rate of 8 months. And within the next, I believe, 5 to 6 years, there's a potentiality that the Black superintendent, male superintendent, will become extinct because of the rate of turnover that we're seeing nationally. You talked about professional development and support to leaders, and this is kind of a subvariate question to this. What would be your strategy or sustainability approach to ensure that the Black male superintendent does not become extinct?
Thank you for bringing up a topic that too few people want to even mention. Their extinction happens by design, from my perspective. Unless there's some world-changing event, most likely the extinction happens because folks have purposely tried to make something extinct. And I have seen it throughout the nation. Folks have come for our Black superintendents in a very strategic, grimy, is that the word I like to use? Anyway. So yes, what you're noting is real, and particularly the Black superintendents who are having a significant impact on the access and opportunities for all of our young people and for our young people. And like myself, like you, when you do that work well, people want to find all kinds of reasons for you not to be there anymore. And it requires a lot to survive it. One, it requires a community that's truly committed. It requires a board, a governance team that gets it and is truly committed and loving. And more importantly, it requires a network. From my perspective, the key to the Black superintendent surviving and then thriving will be the network that we're able to cultivate. This work cannot be done in isolation. This work cannot be done without a support network. This work cannot be done without the influence of an affinity group that includes Black male superintendents. And you know, I've been for the last 4 or 5 years now, I've done everything in my power to bring together the folks who look like us in leading in these ways, just to support each other, to break bread, to laugh, to provide that mental, social, emotional, physical support that we need to do the work, and to bring numbers. And when the work gets hard or when people are coming for one, they can't pick us off one at a time if we come in at this work together. So I hope this makes the affinity group is going to be, from my perspective, the most important thing going forward. We need to rally. We need to rally together in order to survive this thing together. In isolation, we're going to be too easy to pick off. It's going to be too easy to pick us off one at a time. And I'm committed. And I also say, you know, I don't know many Black male superintendents who have survived this, having done this for a long time. Right. I may be the outlier. So what I also know, I'm humble enough to know that at some point your time is going to come. But what I hope I've done and what I hope I'm cultivating is someone to take my place when I'm gone. Mm-hmm. See, we're here only for a short amount of time. Who will we inspire to pick up and take this on? Because you can choose to do a whole lot of other stuff and make more money and have a whole lot less stress. Y'all feel me? So who's going to pick this up and do it when we're gone, when they can choose not to? That's the work. So hope that wasn't too long-winded of an answer, but that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, no, and I'm happy that you unwrapped that and unpacked that, because I know that this is near and dear to your heart, and you want to bring this to NAPSE, and you are the outlier across the country, right? You're kind of like the gold standard. You know, we've seen some really, really good superintendents, specifically African-American male superintendents. I'm going to speak specifically, not leaving out our Black and Brown, our Black sisters that are out there, our brown brothers and sisters. I'm just isolating this specific, I like to say coefficient, right? This specific focus around African male educators, specifically in the superintendent role. And Dr. Brown is the gold standard, 13 years, right? When we come together, we look at actually who's out there that's still in the position. And the constant is Dr. Luvell Brown. So your perspective, your voice, your ability to, I'm going to have to put in this word, survive, right? Mm-hmm. Because the best of the best don't survive as long as you bring that perspective and could bring that leadership to NAVSE. So I appreciate that. And I appreciate you talking about, you know, who is going to be the next generation of leaders to continue the work, the shoulders that we stand on. In my book, Intentional, Bold, and Unapologetic, A Guide to Transforming Schools in ACE Stage of Education, I talk about the shoulders that I leaned on or I was on, you know, that helped me get to be the youngest superintendent in the state of Connecticut at the time and Black male superintendents. I get that. Who are the next shoulders? And Luvell, you're building the shoulders where somebody's going to be able to stand on them. And I appreciate that for the work that you've done nationally. So I want to get into your book because it kind of ties back to a couple questions ago. Culture of Love has been used by many districts, by leaders across the country, internationally. You're talking, you're speaking about it. It's a magnet for change, but it's a magnet to know how to do the work from an organizational standpoint, right? So using your book as a guidepost to affect and enact culture change in this continuous improvement process in the AC stage of education is hard, right? You present an unorthodox, albeit innovative approach in your book to become a culturally responsive agent, change agent, I should say. Now, in a snapshot, right, if my audience have not engaged with you with regards to the major themes from Culture of Love, what are they? And just as, again, a high-level abstraction snapshot of how would it apply to my district if I was a leader, if I was a principal, or even a classroom practitioner?
Thank you for that question. And I'm remiss for not beginning with congratulating you on your wonderful book. You have a bestseller on your hands here, so congrats on doing such a great job with that text, and I hope it gets into the hands of every educator in America. So thank you for your leadership.
I appreciate that, Dr. Brown. So I'm just letting everybody know the podcast show is over. Dr. Brown, shut it down. That's it. That's all I need. I just need my endorsement. Goodbye, Dr. Brown. I'm playing. Well, thank you. I appreciate it, my brother.
It's
really fine.
It's beautiful. Awesome book. And I love how your fraternity colors are embedded throughout.
Oh, here we go. Because,
because mine are embedded throughout mine. So, you know, this quote, I take this lesson from the young people I serve who say, you can't learn with me and you can't teach me unless I know who you are. And so it's pushed us to embed identity work in all that we do, every lesson, every assessment, every unit, every meeting. We do some type of identity exercise so that we're very clear about who we are as leaders before we can begin to be culturally responsive for the young people and learners we serve. Now, saying that, my book explores who I am. I do a bit of a self-reflection about my identity. How did I get here? Who am I? And I do that every single day, but I did a little bit of that in the book so you will know who I am, because unless you know who I am, the rest of the book won't matter because you won't learn with me. So the book, you know, you get a sense of who I am and where I'm from and how I got here. And then I quickly jump into the process I describe as the process to build a sustainable model of excellence particularly around equity and access for all. How do you build that? And so I go through the three distinct stages I mentioned earlier. The first stage is around reflection. Who are we as an individual, as individuals, and who are we as an organization? And we really talk about the ways in which we can be critically self-reflective. What data do we look at? What questions do we ask? What lens do we use to evaluate our current systems, structures, policies? Who are we? What's happening? That reflection is important, because if we do that in a real way, if we do that in a strategic way, with some of the prompts, some of the lessons from my book and my other work, you will then shift to the next stage, which is that I call it their conflict. But see, some states don't like using that word conflict. They like to refer to it as intellectual friction. But if you, you know, If you reflect in a real way, brother, if you reflect in a real way, it's going to lead to some friction. And that's the capacity building. When you truly reflect, we know we can't continue to do what we've always done, which has been exclusive, which has marginalized, which has been oppressive. So then we engage in this oftentimes a long period of time of truly engaging in capacity. What do we need to shift? What barriers need to be removed? What development needs to be in place? That's an important stage. Because then and only then can we lead to that last stage of policy. And I describe in my book the ways in which we must look at the policies, the Board of Education policies, the school handbooks, the rules on the walls, the syllabus. See, there's so many habitual actions that are done unto someone or something that have been written down. And when you do this work in the way that I've done it for so long, the words that speak to inequities and oppression, those words literally jump off the page for me. But you can't truly do a you can't look at that policy and change it unless you've gone through the reflections and the friction first. So my book sort of walks folks through that process, because I say if you go through that process, you're cultivating a culture of love. See, the culture of an organization does not change until you have a true understanding of the existing culture. And then when you apply antidotes, i.e. policy. See, the culture of our organizations currently have been designed by design through the policies we implement. Now, we can go back hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, and look at organizations, governments, systems, and see that the policies have created the culture of exclusion, the culture of racism, sexism, ableism. I speak to how if we're going to change and have access and opportunity for everybody, we need to be cultivating a culture of love. And then I go through and I define the principles of love. And once you define those principles, those habitual actions done unto someone or something, see, love is not a love fest. Love is a struggle. And as Martin Luther King said, and I've learned it as a superintendent, if you're truly cultivating love, love can get you killed. Mm. Love will get you fired. Mm. Because love is not the default when you truly know what it is. And so what I'm about, the work that I'm about every single day is about cultivating a culture of love, and this journey is tough. So I sort of walk folks through that process, the lessons learned, the struggles we've had on that journey, but most importantly, how do you survive it in a way where it becomes sustainable? I hope that was a bit of a snapshot and a trip to inspire people.
That was the $8 version from your book. So now people only got to pay about $25 now, right? But no, I appreciate it, because Lavelle, oh, wow. As you were going through this, right, and I want my audience, I try to use this as a professional learning tool, a mechanism for them to go back, integrate, reflect, ideate, go back, listen to your content or whoever's content, and then reflect and implement, right? Because I want to use this as an asynchronous tool of learning. And to my audience, please, that last answer that unwrapped specific themes around the culture of love, take that, because Dr. Brown was saying a lot, who we are, self-organization, before you can get into any radical stereo change management process, continuous improvement cycles with systems and structures around strategy. You got to look at culture, but before that, you have to assess the culture from this diagnostic lens to be able to find what I like to say, the antecedents for change. And as Dr. Brown was going through this, right, when he was talking about policy work, when he was talking about reflection as important, conflict, right, importance of conflict, I remember, right, and Dr. Brown, I'm going to share this with everybody. You and I sat on, and you know what I'm about to say, we sat on the Learning 2025 National Commission. We'll bring that up. And this National Commission was comprised of, it was a who's who. Yeah. And I saw Lavelle on there. And I remember I DM'd Lavelle and said, you ready to cause some trouble? And Lavelle just smiled. So as we developed this report for the United States Department of Education that was disseminated I believe it was Dr. Cardona and his team with regards to that, the Learning 2025 National Commission report, We actually, Dr. Brown and I, was trying to push the group to include language around anti-marginalization, because in order to really start lamenting the change that we wanted to in a report, we didn't just want it to be a report that had specific action items. We wanted it to go deep into the genetic structures of an organization so that we can reach this level of anti-marginalization. And I know the policy work that Dr. Brown has underscored in Ithaca, and also being a mentor to other superintendents across the country with regards to reaching that level of anti-marginalization. This is another subvariant, Dr. Brown. How do we now, we know that we have to be able to push towards this level of anti-marginalization, the advocacy that we were doing as we were developing or constructing the Learning 2025 National Commission report. If equity is still a taboo in education, are we ever going to reach that level of anti-marginalization that you've been highlighting for years?
Yeah, we're going to get there. I'm an optimist and I'm hopeful. That's why I'm still an educator and a superintendent. If not being optimistic and hopeful, I should probably be doing something else. So I do believe we will get there. I also, as I mentioned early, I have a 50-year vision for the work. It's going to take time. It's going to take different generations of leaders like you and I to lead this. Because what I do know is that we have still today, we have too few leaders who are taking the authentic journey that you and I have. And the authentic journey is very, very different from what I describe as the academic one. See, the academic one, we've been doing very well in our industry, particularly the leaders, where we talk a lot. We send out a lot of articles. We write a lot of articles. We write statements in response to some of this work. We tend to talk about holiday names and statues. I say to folks all the time, I'm from Charlottesville, Virginia. We have folks talk about those statues for generations. And when they came down, nothing really changed around there. See, I'm done with this academic work. See, the academic work can get you awards. The academic journey can get you recognized, but it doesn't really disrupt the existing system. It doesn't really eradicate the inequities. You may see some incremental improvements at best. See, this authentic journey that I'm on, which I've seen too few people decide they want to take this approach, and frankly, too few people survive it, because the authentic one results in access and opportunities for everybody. Absolutely. When we start talking about our schools being laboratories for social change, mm-hmm. you can go into a classroom and really significantly experience agency and efficacy, and you can change what's happening in your local community, particularly around issues around ableism, classism, sexism, and racism. When you can truly do that by going through school, then you know you've done something. When you change the pedagogy, see, I know what culturally responsive teaching strategies look like. I know what pedagogy looks like when it's culturally responsive, and it looks different than what we see most times in schools. It's louder. There's movement. There's differentiation. There's giving over the voice and the choice to young people. See, we don't see that very often. See, when we are on this authentic journey, we are changing policies. We're changing policies that have been designed to produce the inequities that we say we want to eradicate. See, those three things I just mentioned, I can go on, get people fired every day. Because when you start to do that, people feel uncomfortable. People push back. People have to give up privileges, and giving up those privileges result in folks wanting to stop it. See, the academic journey, people have heard me say this before, the academic journey can win you awards.
Yep.
The authentic one will get you fired. And too few people are willing to take that risk.
Right.
And until we get a critical mass, or we have a significant number scale, when we can scale that authentic journey, then we will see what you and I have imagined and dreamed of. I don't see it happening in the next 2, 3, 5 years.
Yeah.
Hopefully in the next 10, 15, 20, if that makes some sense.
Absolutely. And, I'm with you on this journey, because the rationale that I developed my text or book was a new approach to penetrate and interrogate the current construct of the system for educators to use universally, so that we can create that coalition, Dr. Brown, because you're right, we're losing kids. And what I mean by we're losing kids is that A, there is an outdated and archaic model that we're continuously to implement. Two, I want to underscore your statement because you are 1,000% correct. Culture responsive pedagogy is different from traditional pedagogical practices where you see this misnomer of people being saying they're culturally responsive because they're integrating resources into the curriculum. There's a whole, you know, construct of research and theory and practice around culture responsive practices. But I loved how you used the laboratory of change, right, Dr. Brown? But you highlighted one thing that I think a lot of leaders become apprehensive of doing this work is because people feel like, you know, when their privilege is compromised in education, that they're losing something, right? And, you know, that losing something, whatever it may be, creates resistance and opposition, kind of like that cause and effect. But I want to get down to this next question because it kind of, you know, nicely, seamlessly goes into it. And I want to be intentional when I frame this question from the analytical context, but I want you to put it in your words, okay? And please, taking words from my book, answer boldly and unapologetically, all right, my brother? But public education by 2025, right, statistically, 50% of public education is going to be Black and brown, right? There's great discussions that we have about excellence and equity occurring across the country. But again, I want to say, you know, kind of going back to your last answer, leaders and stakeholders are apprehensive. And when we talk about it now, I want to talk about focusing on alignment of that 50% metric for Black and brown students in education. We have to start talking about racial equity. I don't know why we don't have a conversation about racial equity on a consistent basis nationally, when in reality, the demographics of our student population, we have to talk about it. I mean, half our students are Black and brown, right, Dr. Brown? But it's just like we just kind of, you know, push it to a side, right? It's kind of like this, all right, it's there. Implicitly, we acknowledge it, but explicitly, what are the actions and implementation steps to move beyond this? This is because racial equity has been polarized in the education ecosystem, right? Sure. So we're at this inevitable time frame in the AC stage of education that demographic data coupling various outcome metrics that we're seeing, you know, I don't want to talk about the outcome metrics that we see nationally with regards to Black and brown students, but we must talk about race in education and the transformation process that's embedded within the ecosystem. How do we leverage that within this continuous discussion about race in education to truly create an equitable and emergent business or education model that is aligned to the cultural needs of Generation Z and Generation Alpha?
Man, you may be the smartest cat I've talked to in a long time. So thank you again for engaging. It's therapeutic in many ways to talk to someone like you, but it's also just educational and inspirational. You mentioned a statistic. Yeah, you mentioned a statistic that 50% of our young people in this country in public schools will be Black or brown. But I think what we have not uncovered at scale and made a stat that everyone is talking about is that stat around how many school districts in our country have Black or brown students. Mm-hmm. So now while most of the students will soon be kids of color in our schools, they only are in about 500 districts out of close to 13,000. So I want folks to fact check me who are hearing this, and my numbers may be off a little bit, but it's not much. Think about our kids are only in a few or a fraction of the schools in our country, which means that most schools in our country, school districts in our country, young people will go through their entire academic career and will never be in a class with or have an educator of color.
Right.
That's why, because, you know, I've been talking about policy. Policy must change before the culture changes. The policy must change first before the culture changes. That's why today people are writing laws to say we can't even talk about race in schools. How did that happen? How did that happen across the country where it's become taboo to engage in conversations about our country's history and particularly the issues around oppression that we navigate around the country each and every day? I would go back to because too few people, what most folks in most school districts in our country can do so without having anyone push back.
Right.
Now, when it becomes normal to have students who are not Black or Brown in our country have resources in front of them that includes Black and Brown histories, joy, excellence, and the struggles, when it becomes normalized for young people who don't look like you or me to engage in this conversation every single day, when folks are aren't around them who look like you and I, that's when we're gonna win. So I hope I'm making some sense here, because this is I'm in beta form of my thinking here. But what I do know is we've been having the wrong conversation, and I have seen how folks have used policies to make sure we continue to have the wrong conversation. When the white folks in our country see that the future of our country, the economic future of our country, is dependent upon us understanding what it's like to live in a multicultural society, in a multicultural economy, when we finally realize that, hopefully we realize that before our country doesn't, the economy doesn't fall apart. But when we realize that this is good for everybody, then we will see some shifts. But right now, instead of reflecting in a real way and recognizing that the future of our country is dependent upon us having this conversation, we write laws to make sure we don't talk about it.
Yeah. Dr. Brown, this is a subvariant question, right? And this is coupling your data metric, right? If we know that 50% of our students by 2025 are going to be Black and Brown, and there's roughly about 13,000 districts across the country that are only concentrated to 500 districts, then there are roughly around, 12,500 districts that are going to say, we don't need this. How do you reverse that conversation?
You used the word earlier. We were very strategic with our language when we developed our anti-marginalization curriculum. There were a lot of folks who wanted to talk about anti-racist curriculum, and there are a lot of districts doing anti-racist curriculum work. We call it anti-marginalization curriculum because we need to have everyone understand and feel what it feels like to feel oppressed. Well, one, stepping back and make sure everyone understands this notion of identity and that there's a significant amount of diversity in every space we go into. This conversation is about ethnicity, but it's a lot more than about ethnicity. Issues around gender, class, orientation, religion. We need to talk about how our bias, our invisible spots have contributed to us as a species becoming comfortable with marginalizing and oppressing, segregating and excluding. So, yeah, we got to have every young person engage in the conversations and the education that looks like that requires us to push back against oppression and marginalization. When every young person understands what that feels like to be oppressed, what it looks like to shift practices and beliefs, then we will at scale take on issues around ethnicity and race, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, because I think that you clarified a misnomer, right? And I like to say this is an egregious misnomer, where a lot of people have a linear scope on what anti-marginalization work is, right? It is beyond just race, right? I want to focus on racial equity, but what Dr. Brown contextualized so eloquently is that it is gender, right? It is beyond race. There's multiple inequities or disparities that we see within our organizations. And there are groups that are continuously being marginalized, again, outside of the Black and Brown community, right? When we talk about gender equity, when we talk about equity in the context of our LGBTQIA plus community, those are marginalized groups that we see within our teaching and learning organization. And again, you can fact check me on this, but I believe Generation Alpha represents 10% of the community that come from non-traditional homes, right? So that's another level of, you know, excellence, equity, justice, as well as anti-marginalization work that we have to move into the AC stage of education to be aligned with the demographic demand that are coming into our schools today and in the future. So Dr. Brown, thank you for that. And this is the last question, right? and take it how it is. I try to limit educators, you know, to three words, but they just elaborate. And I just say, keep on going, because that's more for my audience. So take it out as it is, my brother. What three words do you want today's audience, right? Today's audience that's listening to this podcast, what do you want them to leave regarding leadership? I like to say the overarching 25,000 foot lens on every specific key variable and thread that you provided my audience today. So what three words should our participants always lean on within their leadership signature when it is challenged or confronted with what they're doing in the context of equity to change their system? What does that leadership signature look like?
In your subtle way, you challenge me, but I'm your best guest so far, so I'm gonna keep it to just three words now. here they go. 1, 2, 3. All right, check it out. But this is one. I mean, the first one is a hyphenated word. Critical self-reflection. Oh, that's three words. Conflict. And love. That's the process I've defined today. Those are the three things we must do over and over again. Those are the three things we must lead our communities through.
Dr. Brown, you have to, because everybody spent about 10 minutes on this answer. You have to repeat those three words again, because that right there captures your whole change management process around culture that underpins the anti-marginalization work that is necessary to reach all. So if you can just say those three words, I would like to say three and a half.
Yeah, I got you. Self-reflection, conflict, love.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Dr. Brown, if my audience wanted to get in touch with you with regards to this cultural change, regards to self-reflection, conflict, because again, as my audience, right, review this podcast, I want them to really unwrap conflict, what conflicts look like in order to achieve that love. But, you know, obviously there might be more questions. How would they be able to reach you, Dr. Brown?
Oh, easy, man. Easy. www.luvelbrown.com. Pretty simple. And I'm an old guy too. So luvelb@gmail.com. You don't know many people who have Luvel B or their first and last name, last initial. So easy, luvelbrown.com or Luvel, luvelleb@gmail.com.
On that note, Dr. Brown, Dr. Luvel Brown, who is running for president of NAPSE, the proud superintendent of Ithaca Public Schools. Thank you for being on Voices for Excellence.
It was an honor. Thank you for inviting me.
Man, it was an honor to have you on, Dr. Brown. I got to call you. We got to talk. We got to catch up. Obviously, we know in the summer, right? I got to head over to the Browns estate. But on that note, everybody, onward and upward. Have a good day.